Okay, so just a quick note about all the assignments. So so we have decided that because right now the strike is still going on, so what happened to all the assignments is that we're still accepting the assignments after the strike. So for example, assignment 5, which is supposed to be due last night, if by any chance if you were unable to submit the assignments, it is okay if you submit the assignments after the strike, that is fine. But our suggestion is that you guys should keep track of submitting the assignments so that you won't have to submit 3 or 4 assignments at the same time. Okay. So because of the schedule that we have right now, so we will still have assignment 6 due next Tuesday, which I have already mentioned about last week. So. So since we have a bit of time for you guys to submit the assignment, so today I'm going to continue on the textbook material. And as far as the second test concerned, the second test will still be on April 1st, which is 2 weeks from today. And there's a very high chance that the second test will be all multiple choice questions, okay? So if it's going to be all multiple choice questions, there will be about 40 multiple choice questions for the test, okay? In terms of the test material, that will be on chapter 4 and 5 from the textbook, and from the grade manual, that will be 3, 4, 5, and 6, okay? So will be the rest of the chapters related to Microsoft Excel, not this one. So the next topic is about operating systems, and that corresponds to chapter 10 in the textbook. So what we have talked about so far is we have talked about some of the detailed aspects about the computing systems. We have talked about numbers, and then we focus on the logic gate circuits, which is the hardware portion of the computing system. So if you look at a more general diagram, what we have here is besides the hardware portion, we also have the software portion in the computer. So this is back to the point when we have, when I talk about the history, we have about the history for the hardware part, and then we have the history for the software portion as well. So when we talk about software, there are two main groups in terms of the software. So we have the application software and the system software. So when we talk about the application software, some of the examples are, for example, Microsoft Excel, Word, or even computer games. So those are the software that allow users to do specific jobs or tasks. System software, on the other hand, is support the internal functions of the computer. So those are the software that most of the time won't be accessible to the users. And users, they don't really care what the system software is about. So the users should only be interacting with the application software. Now, if you look at the system software, we have two major groups. We have the utility software as well as the operating system. Now, as far as the utility software, there are different types of utility software, and we won't go into too much details about that. So the main focus now is on the operating system, which is the core part of the computing system, which is the portion where you will communicate with the application software as well as to the hardware portion of the computer system. Now, if you take a look at the lowest level in this diagram here, we have two levels under the operating system, which is the shell as well as the kernel. Now, we will spend some time to talk about the structure in terms of the operating system based on this diagram here. So some more formal definitions. So like I said, application software is written to address specific needs for the users, so to solve problems in real world situation. So some of the examples, for example, like I said, we have the different softwares that come with the word processing programs, Excel, Microsoft Access, and Word, games, or even inventory control softwares. And system software, it manages a computing system at a more fundamental level. And it directly interacts with the hardware as well as also communicate with the application software as well. So a more formal definition for the utility software is that it is a program for performing several activities that are related to computer installation. So some of the examples are formatting a disk, or maybe copying certain folders or files, or even data compression in the computer system. So like I said, the main focus now, we will spend more time to talk about how the operating systems manage all different kinds of aspects inside the computer systems. So when we talk about the operating system, like I said, we have two levels. The inner level is what we call the kernel. It is like the center of the operating system. And then we have the outer level, which we call the shell. And it is the outer level that is actually interacting with the application software, which allow users to use different types of programs. So here is a more general diagram that shows the interaction between the operating system and the application software, as well as the hardware portion. So we, as the human users, we are most of the time we only interested in dealing with the application software. And for example, if you open Microsoft Excel and then you open a worksheet, and then so whatever that you've done with the application software, the software language will convert to a specific language that the operating system is able to understand. And then the operating system kind of serves as a two-way traffic. So below the operating system, now we have other system software that convert the language that the hardware is able to understand or communicate. Now, when we talk about the hardware, it is actually all different types of registers, or even the CPU that I have mentioned in chapter 5. Like, for example, all the program counter, the instruction register, the memory data register, those key five registers, and the CPU memory, they are all sitting in the hardware portion. So we have spent quite a bit of time to talk about the how the different types of registers interact when we have a small program that is executing in the memory. So if you look at this diagram here, the human users, it is able to communicate with the operating system as well. So those some examples, such as if you want to navigate through the desktop or the directory of the computer system, so those are some examples where the human users will interact with the operating system. So that means the operating system is responsible to properly manage different kinds of tasks within the computer system. So the general idea is how to manage nicely all this kind of different aspects between the application software as well as the hardware portion inside the computing system. So multiprogramming is a very important technique, that keeping multiple programs in the main memory at the same time, and these programs which are sitting in the memory will compete for the CPU to execute that particular program. Because the CPU can only execute one program at the same time, so it is the operating system to keep track which program to be executed next. And we will talk about how to the several different management aspects with respect to the CPU process. So in terms of the resources management, we can divide up this one into three major groups. So we have the memory management. So the memory, as we have said earlier, that we refer to the random access memory in the CPU. We will talk about the process management. Process in this case, which also refer to the program. So process, program, we refer to the same thing. And the third thing is the CPU scheduling. So the CPU, like I said, is responsible to decide which program to go to the execution process. And different process or different programs, they require different time to execute that particular program. And it is the CPU, it is the operating system job to decide which program to go to the next stage. So if you go back to this diagram here where we have the memory, and this is just a simplified version of the memory. And what we have here highlighted in the red text here, so this is the address. And the address here is expressed in decimal numbers. And we know that in real world and in the actual situation, all these addresses, they should be expressed in binary numbers. So we always start from zero, and then we increment one at a time and go all the way down. So each memory cell, which correspond to each rectangular block here, it will have an unique memory address. So computer these days, we have gigabyte or even going to terabyte memory. So it is very rare that have a program that will require all the memory in the computer to execute that particular program, considering the such a large memory that we have in the computer system. So what we do usually is we have to divide the memory up so that we can have multiple programs that can be using the memory at the same time. So we will talk about how to divide the main memory up into smaller pieces, or the other term is how do we partition the main memory to allow multi-programming in the the main memory. So there are two terms that we have to talk about when we talk about partition the main memory. So the first one is the logical address, and the second one is the physical address. So the main definition about the logical address is that it is the value that specifies a generic location relative to the program, but it's actually not the actual memory address. The actual memory address is the physical address, which is the second term here. And I will go into a bit more details about how do we distinguish which one is the logical address and which one is the physical address. So I guess a good example is that if you go back to chapter 5, where I have a small program, the program actually does not start from 0000, and it starts somewhere along the main memory. So that small program, or if you want to call that small process, if you start from the first instruction in that small program, from the small program point of view, you start from 000, but in the actual main memory, it does not start at 000. You start from somewhere along the main memory. So we will talk about that later on today. So the operating system, you must employ some kind of methods or techniques so that you will keep track of how the program is actually located in the main memory, because we know that we have multi-programming, so we have multiple programs or processes that are located in the main memory, and the operating system must somehow tell where the program is located in the main memory. And the way to do this is we will convert the logical addresses into the actual memory address inside the main memory device. So when we talk about the first management, which is the memory management, we have three different ways to manage the memory. So we have the single contiguous memory management. The second one is the partition one, and the third one is a paged memory management. And we will see that it is the last one, which is the paged memory management, which will give us the most efficient way to manage all the memory locations in the random access memory. So the single contiguous memory, as the name suggests, what happened is we have a single block of memory that only support one program. So I just want to follow what we have, what the textbook discussed. So in the main memory, what it does is we will usually reserve the upper part for all the programs that are required for the operating system. And then after that, we will have the actual application program. So according to this diagram here, we have only two blocks, which is we have the operating system sitting in the top, and then we just have a big single block of memory that support only one program. So using this structure, this is very simple because we only have a one big block for one program. But like I said, in today's computers, memory, and it is not a good idea to waste such a big memory space to support just only a single program. So when we talk about the logical address and the physical address, So here is the first example just to illustrate the difference between the logical address and the physical address here. So suppose we have a single program that is sitting in the application program at this point. So A here, you will refer to the address of the first instruction of the program. And L essentially is the relative address relative to the starting position of the program. So if we just focus on the application program, L refers to the address of that instruction in the particular program. But if you look at the entire memory space, the actual instruction of that particular program is actually sitting in the address given by A plus L, because we do not consider A when we look at the logical address. So the actual address in this case will be given by A plus L. So because of the disadvantage of the single contiguous memory, of course, a better way is we have to divide that big block up into smaller pieces. And the term here that we will use is partition memory management. So by doing this, we will have more than one application program in the main memory at the same time that share the memory space. So in this case, we have to somehow come up with certain types of partition techniques that divide that memory space up into smaller pieces. So we have two techniques here. We have the fixed partitions and dynamic partitions. So as the name suggests, the fixed partitions refer to that when we want to divide the main memory up, each block will have the same size. You will have a fixed size. But in terms of the dynamic partitions, the size of each process or the smaller pieces, you will have the different sizes. And the dynamic partition will divide the main memory up depends on the need of the actual program. So some program you will require more memory, some program you will require less memory. So dynamic partitions will give us more flexibility in terms of dividing the main memory up in the main memory device. So here is an example of a dynamic partition memory. So again, this is a diagram that is taken from the textbook. So in this case here, again, we have the operating system sitting at the top in the main memory. And then we have three processes in this case here. We have process one, and then we have a empty block, and then we have process two, process three, and then we have an empty block again. So if you look at the size of process one, process two, and process three, they have different sizes. So this is an example of a dynamic partition. So if you look at this diagram here, we have two empty blocks here. So say, for example, if we have the fourth program or the fourth process that is coming in, so we will have to check if the size of the empty block is big enough to fit in the fourth process. So if, for example, if the fourth process is small enough to fit in the first empty block, then we will have a smaller piece of empty block that we left over after we fit in the fourth process. So the operating system is actually responsible to check if the size of the empty block can satisfy the size of the additional program. So that's why we have this checkpoint here to check if the length is of the incoming program is greater than the empty block. So we have certain registers here in the operating system that tell that information to know whether that additional process will occupy the entire empty block in the main memory device. So one advantage with the dynamic partition memory is that you see that we have two empty blocks in this diagram here. So what it does is eventually, say for example, if the fourth process comes in and it takes, let's say, half of this empty block here, this block will reduce the size and we will have a smaller empty block. So what dynamic partition memory does is it will collect all the empty blocks and merge them together to form a bigger empty block. So that will give a much larger empty block, so that in case if the fifth process comes in, you will have a higher chance that you can fit the additional process. So that is the advantage of dynamic partition memory, the fixed partition memory is not able to do so. So again, if we look at the logical address and the physical address, for example, in this case, we have the process three sitting in this block here. And A here, again, refers to the starting address of that particular program. And of course, the physical address in this case will be A, which is given by, you can say, the magnitude starting from the initial point going through here. And L, which is the logical address, is the length from starting starting from the initial address in the process 3, going into the actual instructions in process 3. So just want to give you an example. So this is something that I have mentioned that when we talk about the definitions of a logical address and physical address. So this is exactly the same program that I took from the previous chapter. So here we have a small program that consists of less than 10 instructions here. So remember, we have the data or the instruction sitting in each memory cell will consist of the operation code as well as the address of the memory. So in this case here, the instruction here is we want to load the content or the information sitting in this address, which is given by 01000, which is given by this data here. And the second instruction is we want to add the data that is sitting in this instruction, which is given by this address, which is given by 01001, so essentially which is this data here. And so 011, which is the operation code in this example, refers to the add instruction. So we have a small program here that corresponds to one process in the main memory. So if you look at this example here, the actual program starts, the physical address is given by this address here. So if we convert 010100 to decimal number, that corresponds to number 4. But if you look from the small program point of view, the first instruction, this is actually equal to 0. So the logical address of this instruction is 0, but the physical address of this instruction is equal to 4, okay? So when we talk about partition memory, so remember that we have some kinds of empty blocks that must be left over in terms of the main memory device. So we need to somehow come up with some methods or techniques that can fully utilize the leftover or the empty blocks. So we have three approaches in terms of the partition selection. So the first one is the first fit. So it refers to when the program is allocated to the first partition that is big enough to hold the additional program. The second one, which is the best fit, refers to the program is allocated to the smallest partition that is big enough to hold the additional process. And the last one, which is the worst fit, is the case where the additional program is allocated to the largest partition that is big enough to hold the program. Now, if you think about all these three approaches here, in terms of the fixed partition memory, because the sizes of all the partition, they will be the same, and the fact that all the leftover, they won't be merged together to form a bigger empty block, the worst fit is the worst selection for the fixed partition memory. And the best way to work with the fixed partition memory is to use the best fit technique, because this way we will always allocate the smallest partition that is just big enough to hold the additional process. Now, on the other hand, with respect to the dynamic partition memory, the worst fit actually will work the best, because we know that in the dynamic partition, you will always, the leftover pieces, you will always merge together to form a much bigger pieces. So in that case, the worst fit will give the best scenario for the dynamic partition memory. Okay, so these are just some general approaches how to do the partition selection with respect to the two different types of partition techniques. So this is just like what I have said, in dynamic partition, the empty partitions will merge together to form a big empty block. So what I have mentioned so far, they are referred to partition memory. So the third type is what we call a page memory management. So when we talk about a page memory management, you can always visualize this one is more like reading a book, because a book, you have multiple pages. And the idea behind the page memory management is very similar to a book as well. So here is just a general diagram just to illustrate how page memory actually work. So we have the main memory here. And what it does is we will divide the main memory into different frames, and each of these frames here will have same size. So suppose that we have two processes. So we have P1, which is process 1, P2 is process 2. So what we do in this case is we will divide each process into smaller pieces again. So if you look at P1 in this case, we divide the first process into 5 smaller pieces. And what we do in this case is we will scatter all these 5 pieces around in the main memory. So if you look at the main memory now, we have the green block, which corresponds to the pieces that refer to process 1, and we have the blue blocks that refer to the instructions for process number 2. So for example, if you look at the first piece in process 1, what we do here is when we divide the process, each of these processes into smaller pieces, we have a new term that refers to each piece. And what we call that a page. So in this case, we have 5 pages for process 1. And process 2, in this case, is a smaller process or smaller program. So we divide this one into 4 pages. If you look at the first page here, we have a page number corresponding to that particular piece here. And we have the frame number that assigned to the actual memory. So for example, we have page 0. This will go to frame number 5 in the memory. So we see that we have process 1, page 0 go to frame 5 in the main memory. And then we have page 1, which corresponds to frame 12 in the main memory. So we see that process 1 and page 1 is sitting in frame 12 in the main memory. So we see that instead of grouping the process into a single block, we divide the process into smaller pieces or different pages again. So essentially, we will see that process 1 is scattered around in the main memory. Same thing for process 2 as well. And of course, when we talk about the logical address and the physical address, in this case, it will be a little bit more complicated compared to the partition memory management. So in terms of the logical address, in this case, we usually use 2 terms to define it. We have the page number as well as the offset. So we'll take a look and to how this works in page memory management. So suppose if we look at the first page in process 1 here, and we know that this corresponds to frame 12 in the main memory. So just in this example, that assume that the size of each frame here, it has 1024 bytes. So this corresponds to 2 to the power 10. And a logical address of remember, the definition here is 1 refer to the page number, and 200 here refer to the offset. So since we assume that the size of each frame has the same size of each page, so the page size will be 1024 bytes as well. So if you want to find out the actual physical address that is sitting in the main memory, so what we do is we have to multiply the number of frames with the actual size of each page. And then we have to add the offset to the final result. So what we do here is we know that page 1 corresponds to frame 12. So we have 12 times 1024 because each frame here has a size of 1024. So we have to multiply that by 1024. And then we have to add with the offset, which is 200 in this case. And so So 12,000 here, 488 essentially is the actual address location for that particular instruction. Yes?
Sorry, how do you get the offset?
Oh, this is just an example. So the operating system will communicate with the hardware portion, and they will communicate with each other to find out the actual offset in that scenario. So compare this one with the partition memory. So we see that we have the 200 in this case, you can think this one essentially as the logical address in the single contiguous memory management. But in this case here, because we divide each process into different pages again, so we have to provide the page number in the logical address in the page memory management. So that is basically what I would like to talk about in terms of the the memory management. So remember that we have three types of management that we want to talk about. The second one is the process management, and the third one is the CPU scheduling. So we will continue to talk about what the actual process management does. So if we go back to this diagram here, so we know that we can, in the main memory, we can have multiple processes sitting in the main memory at the same time. And this is why we call this is a multi-programming technique. So process management is kind of the management that refers to how do we handle all these multiple programs or processes at the same time. Some process, they may have higher priority to go into, or some of them, they can wait. Some of them, they have a longer time to run, or some of them, they have shorter time to run. So we have to take those aspects into account and decide which one to go to the actual running state. So this is more or less the general diagram that we want to refer to when we talk about the process management. And so essentially, each block here represents each state inside the process management. So new here, of course, that refers to we have a new process coming in. And in that case, we have a new process coming into the main memory, and we're assuming that the process is small enough to fit into the additional empty blocks in the main memory. So once the new process coming in into the memory, so you will go into the what we call the ready block, and that means we are ready to execute that program. But at this point, the process is just ready to be executed, but it's not yet executed by the CPU yet. Remember, the CPU always only execute one process at one time. So that means we can have multiple processes sitting at the ready block, and it is the CPU to decide which one to dispatch and going into the running state. So say, for example, the computer system, the operating system is able to tell which process to go to. So that particular process or program now is going into the running state. Once the process is in the running state, it will be executed by the CPU, and it is, remember, the fetch, decode, execute cycle, so that will be happening in the running state at this point. So we will have multiple instructions sitting in a single program that will be in the running state at that moment. Now, at any point, the process in the running state can be stopped or terminated at any time, because that depends on how the operating system manage the rest of the processes. Say, for example, if we have a new process coming in and that new process has a higher priority, then that new process can go in first. And whatever that is actually running initially, you will go back to the ready state again, wait until the new process is done, and then it decides whether that previously process will go back to the running state again. Now, at any point, the process that is already executed by the CPU may require new information from the input or output devices. For example, if we're adding numbers, subtracting numbers, the process may want to get new data from the memory. So at that time, at that point, the executed process or program will go to the waiting state, and you will wait there until you get the updated information from the memory. So once it get the new or the updated information, you will go back to the ready state again. So if you just refer to this diagram here, you can see these three blocks, the ready, the running, and the waiting constitute to the three key blocks inside the process management. And again, you can see that at any point, the running state, which correspond to the fetch, decode, execute cycle inside the CPU, can only execute one process or one program at a time. So say, for example, that process or program has completed its execution, so it will exit and what we call it terminates that particular process. And at this point, that particular process or program has completely executed. So that's more or less about what process management is about. So what we expect that you guys to know in terms of those management process is the key idea behind the process management, some of the definitions, or for example, waiting or ready, what is the difference between the waiting state and the ready state. So those are some definitions or functions that we expect you guys to know during the test or on the exam. So as far as the last management concern is the CPU scheduling. So CPU scheduling is more or less, it works with the process management because like I said, CPU scheduling, this is more or less like an action to determine which process to go from the ready state into the running state. So again, if we refer to this diagram here, we have multiple processes sitting at the ready block, and the CPU has to decide which one to go into the running block. So when we talk about the CPU scheduling, we have two types of scheduling that we want to refer to. The first one is, if we go back to this diagram again, so imagine that we have a process that is in the running state. At, remember I mentioned that, for example, if you want to add numbers or subtract numbers, at any point the process wants to get new information or new data, it has to stop running, or you have to stop the fetch decode execute cycle and go back to the waiting state. So in that case, that particular process or program give up the CPU by itself. So that is what we call the non-preemptive scheduling. So in that case, the decision is actually made by the process that is currently executing. The other type, if I go back to this diagram again, imagine that we have the process that is currently running or executing at this point. Say, for example, we have a new program that is coming in and the CPU decide that, well, it's time to execute the new program because it has a higher priority. So the CPU will have to terminate what is currently running in this process and dispatch the new additional program into the running block. So in that case, the CPU made the decision that it wants to execute a more higher priority process. So that scheduling, it refers to preemptive scheduling. So in that case, the process itself does not give up by itself, but it is the CPU that informed the process that we have a new additional higher priority process coming in. So in these two cases, in these two types of scheduling, we have a special term which we call the turnaround time. By definition, it is the amount of time between when the process arrives in the ready state to the time it exits the running state for the last time. Okay, so we will, again, we will talk about how this turnaround time play a key role in terms of the scheduling issues inside the CPU. When we talk about the CPU scheduling, so we have, again, we have different types of techniques that refer to the CPU scheduling. The first one, which is the most basic one, is what we call the first come, first served. So by the name, so you know that we have the first process that coming in, we will execute that process. And so in this case, whether or not the first process is going to take much longer time or shorter time, you will execute the first process first. So so here is an example. So in this example here, we have five processes that are coming in into the ready state. So again, if I go back to this diagram now, we have five processes that are sitting in the ready block, and we have to decide which one to go into the running state. So according to this diagram here, P1, we assume that P1 comes first, and P2 comes next, and then the next one is P3. And the surface time here is 140 time units. So, well, usually the time unit in this case will be in the orders of nanosecond or picosecond, depends on how fast the clock is running inside the CPU. So in this case, if you look at process one, it requires 140 time units. The second one only requires 75 time units. But because based on the first come, first serve technique, even though P2 requires less time compared to P1, P1 will be executed first. So if we put all this information on in a single diagram, so if we look at P1 in this case, starting from time zero, because it requires 140 time units, so we have by the end of 140, we will complete P1. Now P2 requires 75 time units. So what happened is we have to add 75 after 140, that will give us 215. So that's why we see 215 at the end of P2. Same thing for P3. P3 in this case, it requires 320 time units. So what we do is we have to add 320 to 215, and this will give us 535 by the end of P3. And the same thing goes on for P4 and P5. When we calculate the average, so if essentially all these numbers here are what we refer to the turnaround time. So the P1 here will have 140 time units. P2 will have to take the time that is required to execute P1. So it's answered the turnaround time for P2 will be the sum of 75 time units plus 140 time units. When we talk about the average turnaround time, how we calculate this one is we have to add up all the turnaround times for all the 5 processes, and then we divide the number of process in the ready state. So in this case, we have 140 plus 215 plus 535 plus 815 plus 940, and divide that number by 5, and we will get 529. Okay. So this is an example to show what we mean by the turnaround time and what we mean by the average turnaround time. So again, you guys should be able to calculate these numbers by these definitions. So the next CPU scheduling is what we call the shortest job next. So by looking at this name, the physical meaning is that the CPU will always execute the process that requires the shortest time. So again, if we go back to the same example, so we have FC, first come first, this should be FCFS, short for first come first shift. So this one here is what I have shown in the previous slide. And the bottom one here essentially is the turnaround time for these 5 processes if we execute them by using the shortest job next CPU scheduling. So if you look at the example again, so we see that P2 requires the shortest time, so that's why P2 will go first. So we have 75 time units for the first one, and then the next one is P5. So P5, it requires 125 time units. So we have 125 plus 75, so that's why we see 200 by the end of P5. And then the next one, we see that we have 140. So P1, the process one requires 140 time units. So we have to add 140 to 200. And by the end of P1, we see 340. And the same thing goes on for P4 and P3. So if we compare these two diagrams here, we see that the total amount of time, of course, they must be equal to each other because we are just adding up all these numbers essentially. But if you look at the turnaround time, that will be different. So again, so the diagram on the left here is the turnaround time for the technique where we use the first come first served, where the other one here, which is the shortest job next, is the turnaround time that I just show in the bottom block diagram here. So again, if we use the same way that we calculate the average turnaround time, we would just add up all these numbers here and then divide the total by 5. We see that the average turnaround time is 435 time units. So we see that there's some slight improvement compared to the first come first serve technique. Okay, so those are two most fundamental CPU schedulings when we talk about how CPU to determine which process to go first. Now, the last one that we will talk about is the round robin scheduling. And what it does in this case here is divide the, we will first assign a particular time slice or time quotient into each process. And this particular time slice will be the same for all the processes. So let's take a look at the example again. So suppose that we assume that the time quantum or the time slice in this case is 50 time units. So what it means is that we will execute all 5 processes at the same time and based on the time slice here. So if we look at this diagram here, we have 50 time units to execute P1. We have 50 time units to execute P2. And same thing for P3, P4, and P5. Now, by the end of P5 here, we go back and execute P1 again. So in this case here, 50 time units in the first case is used to execute P1, which requires 140. So by the time we get into this point here, P1 will require 90 time units to execute the rest of the program. So the next one here, we have P2 again. Now we see 325 at this point here because we have 50, 100, 150, 200, 250, and 300. So what we left in P2 is that P2 requires only 75 time units. So what we do in this case, we have 50 here. So by the time we finish executing P2, we only add 25 to 300. So that's why we see 325. Now we continue to execute the rest of the processes. So we have P3 again, which requires 50 for P3, 50 for P4, and 50 for P1. Again, remember P1, we only required 140 time units. So by the time we get to this point, we only have 40 time units left. So we only need to add, well, in this case, we have 50, 50, 50 again. So we need to add 150 to 325. That gives us a total of 475. So by the time we get to this point here, we have to add 40 time units to the total here, and that's why we got 515 by the end of P1. Now at this point here, because P2 has already executed its program, so we won't execute P2 again, but instead we will continue on P3 and P4, and the process repeat again and again until we finish all five processes. So if we go back to the shortest job scheduling, one of the main disadvantages is that because it's always look for the shortest, you always look for the program that requires the shortest time to execute. So say for example, we only have five processes at this point. If we have P6 coming in that required much shorter time to execute, that means the process that requires much longer time to execute will have to sit in the ready state for a very long time until all the other processes are completed. So that means any process that requires much longer time will have to wait for a very, very long time until the rest of the processes are completed. So the round-robin scheduling has the advantage that we are actually doing multiple processes or executing multiple processes at the same time. So in that way, we won't have any process that is sitting in the ready state for a long time. So just for a better explanation, so I put up this diagram here just to show how we get all these numbers in the top. So you see that we have round one corresponding to the first scenario here, and then we will go to round two. So this is why we call this one as a round robin scheduling. So so if you have some time, you can study the rest of the slides that I have given here. So what I did in this case is I put up the actual round after in this round robin scheduling example. So just try to study this example, and if you have any questions, I will take this one up again on Friday. So on Friday, I will try to go back to the great manual, and then I will start chapter 7. Thank you.